be in Ezekiel 38 and 39 today, and I wish I could go hide under a bed, to tell you the truth, instead of having to interpret this, because I really don't know how to interpret it. And I want to share with you the struggle so that you may see the difficulties here before you make up your mind as you pray instead of your Bible. And a difficult passage like this, and the reason it's difficult, I'll get into when we get into the text itself. You look for a parallel passage. You try to find if the names are mentioned somewhere else or if the events are mentioned somewhere else, because hopefully a parallel passage will give you greater insight. Well, the word Gog and Magog is mentioned in Revelation 20, verse 8. And the phrase, the latter days on that day, is found throughout here. And so many have said it's an eschatological, apocalyptic chapter. And I think there's some truth in that. But when I say that, I don't want to lose all historical significance to Ezekiel's major theme, which runs all the way from chapters 36 to 39, which is the physical restoration of the Jewish nation after the Babylonian exile. Now, I want to take this text very, very seriously because I believe it's the inspired, authoritative Word of God. Even if I don't understand it, I want to make the text supreme. I'm afraid I don't want to push the details because it seems to me that when I try to find a historical fulfillment or even fit it into an eschatological framework, the details become very ambiguous and very fluid. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Where does this fit historically? Well, first of all, you try to find these place names and leaders' names in some kind of event in history connected with the return from the exile or connected with some other point in history. And we have none. Then it's obvious that it's future because it talks about in the last days. And so is it a group of passages that deal with the growing intensification of evil, the growing antagonism to the people of God? And is this a chapter that simply is it one of many to describe that end time tension between God's people and the world's people? Or is it to be understood as connected with one of the end time battles like Armageddon or whatever? Now, it's amazing to me how dispensational commentators, they have proof text after proof text after proof text from this chapter. And everybody who's not dispensational doesn't want to talk about it. So I'm glad the dispensationalists are willing to struggle with an ambiguous text. And I'm discouraged that mainline commentators, classical commentators, have been willing to ignore this or leave it out, because I want to tell you, it is a ball of worms. Some dispensational premillennialists try to link this to Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 through 45. But if you'll look at Daniel 11, 40 through 45, you'll see it's a battle between the king of the north and the king of the south, and Palestine, or the Jewish people, just happened to be caught in the middle between those two world powers. Some have tried to link it to Revelation 16, the Battle of Armageddon. But the Battle of Armageddon is all the nations of the earth arrayed against Israel on the northern plains around Megiddo, the Eshkelon Valley. But this chapter is primarily on the mountains of Israel, is the allusion here. And it seems to be mostly a northern confederation, although there are some mercenary groups from the four corners of the earth mentioned in chapter 38. Now, because it's been mentioned, the very names Gog and Magog are mentioned in Revelation 20, verse 8, some have said that's where it fits. It's the end battle after the millennium, before the eternal kingdom. Well, if you'll look at Revelation chapter 20, verse 8, you'll see that John has taken Old Testament imagery, as he always does, and has slightly redefined it for his use. If you look at Gog and Magog in Revelation 20, they are two Gentile world leaders. But here in 38, it seems to be that Gog is a name or a title of a leader from the land of Magog. And John has changed it to two leaders. And so we see there that it's slightly changed in Revelation 20. And the setting is different. Well, what do we do with this? Well, I think we have to exegete it. We must struggle with the text seriously, no matter what our preconceived theological biases is. But after we have struggled with the text exegetically, historically, geographically, after we've done all that, then we're going to have to fit it somewhere into our overall view of the scope of God's plan for history. Now, I think I can exegete it, but I'm not sure I know where it fits in time. I do believe that there is going to be a great intensification of evil right before the second coming. I do believe the Bible has given us many pictures of end-time events. My real problem comes when we get so dogmatic on the exact sequence of these events when the language is extremely apocalyptic and very symbolic and ambiguous. And so I want to take it seriously. I don't want to push the details. And when I'm through, I want to admit to you that I still don't completely understand. I want to list a few books for you before I start. This is an awful good book. It's called Time and History by Mathis Riesi. And it'll really give you an insight you probably haven't got before. It's basically on the book of the Revelation and eschatology and prophecy, that kind of thing. Time and History by Riesi. A book I really enjoy is Prophecy Interpreted, and it's by John P. Milton, which I think gives a good scope. And then when I was reading through this, I want to tell you the pulpit commentary was so helpful because it mentioned a lot of Jewish commentators, it mentioned some classical Christian commentators, and just dealt with the text, I think, in a very forthright manner. And so I want to commend it for its interpretation of Ezekiel. Let's go to the text then, if we could. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face toward Gog. Now, it's obvious because of the use of geographical terms and that 38 and 39 are a unit, a literary unit describing something. Okay? Now, notice where it says, the land of Magog. Now, this seems to be that May is used as land, so it's the land of Gog. Now, Magog and all of these geographical locations are mentioned in several chapters in the Old Testament. If you'll go back to Genesis 10, which is kind of the dispersion of the races from Noah's three sons, you'll see that these basic tribes are Gentile tribes. They're from Japheth. Gomer is a grandson from one of his sons. But they're identified in Genesis 10, 2, and 3. They're mentioned again in Ezekiel chapter 27 that lists the commercial trading centers of Ezekiel's day and the particular items they were famous for. These groups are mentioned there. They're also mentioned in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, 5 through 7. Now that's where they're mentioned. They seem to be, Josephus says, they are Scythian tribes. We would think of the northern tribes, Germanic barbarians, those nomadic tribes of the Caucasus Mountains, the north of the Black Sea, that kind of thing. Now, notice it mentions that the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Now, Rosh is the normal Hebrew word for head or chief. Everywhere else in the Bible it appears, it's translated chief. Some think it means a place name here. Other commentators translate it like the Revised Standard Version, which makes it the head prince or the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Because it's not mentioned as a place name anywhere else in the Bible, because the word primarily means head, I think it's unfortunate for us to make it a place name. Now, we know from history that there are some ancient peoples that are close to this, and so maybe it is ancient peoples. It's unfortunate to me that dispensationalists try to make this modern Russia. Let me say this to you real carefully. I want you to hear me, and I hope you'll hear me from my prayerful, studied, admittedly in error opinion. What we're tending to do in our day in eschatology is to force the entire Bible to speak to our modern situation. They did the same thing in World War II. They did the same thing back in the Reformation. It seems that every generation of Christians tries to force the biblical text into their day. Now, I agree with you that Israel being back in the land and an obstinate power to the north is very significant as far as biblical prophecy. That doesn't mean it's conclusively this age. I believe when the last generation comes, all of these prophecies are going to fall in line so miraculously to give courage to that generation amidst persecution. Obviously, then, I am a post-trib eschatologist, and I think the church will go through this time of terrible persecution, and these literally fulfilled prophecies will be a great encouragement to that generation. But I think we're pushing too hard to make this Russia. It might be, but at this point, we can't be academically certain, and we can't just base it on current experience because we're dealing with an ancient text that we're not sure has come to fruition in our day. Now, Meshach and Tubal are mentioned along with Gomer and Togarmah as these northern peoples. We would say the northern people from above modern Turkey, clear across the northern part of the old Babylonian and Assyrian empires, those people clear across there. Now, I want to mention that, let me go on. And say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, or head prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn about and put hooks into your jaws. Now, some who see this as the cosmic battle between good and evil have said, well, this is the exact same phrase used of the sea monster, mythological sea monster, depicted in the Nile River in chapter 29 of Ezekiel, verses 3 through 5, which they say gives an evidence for it being the cosmological struggle between the people of God and the people of the evil one. I'm not sure I'll buy that, because this is used in several other places, and this was, we know, an Assyrian way of treating enemies. Now, I will bring you out, verse 4. Now, in Revelation 20, verse 8, it is Satan that stirs up the nations. So that's why I don't think Revelation 20 and Ezekiel 38 can automatically be identified. Here, it's God stirs up this nation to bring them against his people. And the whole purpose of these two chapters is to show that he's God and that he's not weak. And the reason Israel was taken into exile is because of their sin, not because of God's weakness. So God's going to overthrow a huge Gentile army to show not only his people, but the nations that he is a powerful God. And it was Israel's sin that caused their deportation. Now, when I say that chapter 38 in Revelation 20 can't be identified, at the same time, I also know that God hardens Pharaoh's heart, and yet it says Pharaoh hardened his own heart. I also know that in 2 Samuel 24:1, it says David numbered Israel, and 1 Chronicles 21:1, it says Satan caused him to number Israel. One, God did it, one, Satan did it. I realize there's that tension in the Bible. If you're thinking of ultimate causes, there's only one, God. Sometimes God uses the evil one. Sometimes God knows men's minds and uses their evil tendencies. And so I know there's an ambiguity here, and I realize that. Now, the nations mentioned in verse 5, Persia, Ethiopia, Put. This seems to be a way of talking about the whole world is against Israel, though the main power is from the north. These are mercenary elements in their army. Persia would be east, Ethiopia south, and Put to the west. The Septuagint has Libyans in 27:10, where the same word appears. Now, it is true that there may be some identification with these tribes as being in other localities. We're not sure of these nations. It seems there's some evidence that these may be titles for geographical locations surrounding Babylon. Possible, but traditionally they are in Africa. Now, notice they're going to come with shield and helmet. Always the prophets spoke in their day. They used helmets and shield and spears and bows. That doesn't mean it's not going to be an end-time army equipped with modern mechanized equipment. It simply means they're speaking the language of their day. Now, to say we're not going to push the details, or if some say we're going to, and yet say this means modern weaponry. Others say we're not going to, and say it means you've got to have an old-style army. So you're really in a bind sometime with this kind of literature. Now, Gomer is mentioned in verse 6 and Genesis 10:2, with all the troops, and in Gormath, this seems to be the house of horses, maybe, and we get it from the area of Armenia. I would say 27:14 and Genesis 10:3. It seems to be modern Turkey or that area through there, from the remote parts of the north. Now, remember, the remote part of the north, because it was the only accessible land bridge into Palestine, became a proverb for evil. So some say this just means the evil from the north as a proverb speaking of end-time evil. And I know that's true, and it's used that way, but it seems to me we're in such a historical setting. There are so many place names that we need to be careful about spiritualizing just to fit our preconceived notions. Let's see. Notice in verse 8, it mentions, and you are summoned. The word here is visited. It can mean visited for blessings or judgment. Here it seems to be they're going to be visited with judgment. In the latter years. Now, look at verse 16, look at verse 18, look at verse 19, where the latter years in that day is used. Obviously, we're in an eschatological, apocalyptic chapter looking at end-time events to some extent. I mentioned to you back in chapter 37, we need to be careful that sometimes, like 37, it's speaking of a historical restoration of the nation of Israel. It's got to be that. But there may be a historical foreshadowing to the Messiah's kingdom because of the use of David the Messiah and the eternal kingdom. And that's the same thing here. I would wish I had something historically I could lock it into and then foreshadow it future. But I don't have something historically, and the reference in the future is ambiguous. This is usually used in the Bible for an eschatological reference. Genesis 49:1, Numbers 24:14, Isaiah 2:2, Daniel 10:14, and Micah 4:1. Eschatological, end time. Now, notice it mentions They are to live securely, all of them in verse 8. That's repeated in verse 11 and 14. The attack on Israel will be unexpected, and they will be unprepared. Well, that doesn't fit modern Israel at all, does it? They're armed to the teeth. Just let anybody try to mess with them, and they'll whack their head off. So this does not seem to fit the current situation at all. It seems to fit the return of the exile before they had time to rebuild their walls. But they weren't living securely either. They were always worried about the surrounding nations. This deal of the mountains of Israel is a carryover back from chapter, I think it's about 36, where it talks the mountains are personified to bless them, and here they're used again. Notice in verse 9, there could be like a cloud covering the land, a storm, speaks of the suddenness of it, speaks of the overwhelming numbers of it. When we get in chapter 39, it's going to take them years to bury the dead, and they'll burn the weapons, obviously wooden weapons, they think, for 7 years. So it's a huge army that's going to come. Notice where it mentions in verse 10, God's going to put these thoughts in the leader's head, who's named Gog. Whether that's a real name or a fake name, we don't know. Here's a good place for me to stop, I guess, and go through some of the things of Gog. Something refers to G-Y-G-E-S, the king of Lydia, known as Gugu in Babylonian documents, 670 to 652 B.C. Some think it's Gagea, a place of the barbarians from the Tel Armana letters, also called Gesa. And some think it's Gaga, the god of the Rosh Shamra text. And some think it's the Sumerian Gug, which means darkness, which being the mythological, but cosmological fight between good and evil. See all the possible references here? I don't know. I think probably it's just a name to stand for some Gentile leader. Now, let's see. The unwalled villages are mentioned in verse 11 here again. Notice it says in verse 12, to capture spoil and seize plunder. They weren't going to settle the land. They just wanted to kind of run through and rape it, what they wanted to do, and take the spoils back. Now, all of these nations mentioned in verse 13. Let's see. Notice all the questions in verse 13. By the way, verse 12. See what it says, the center of the earth? That's the navel of the earth. The Jews thought their land was the center of the earth. Ezekiel 5:5 is another reference to being the navel. The purpose of the invasion was spoil. Some say, well, they were after the Arabian oil. Well, if you get so locked in the modern day, you force our day to... It doesn't say they're after Arabian oil or Egyptian oil. It says they're after spoils they can get quickly and leave, not stay and run refineries. Be careful of reading too much in here, folks. Verse 13, a lot have said, well, this refers to these folks are trying to stop them. And I want to show what people do. See the word villages? It means young lions. Well, this translation, villages, comes from the Peshitta, the Septuagint, and the RSV follows that. Well, if you think that England is involved in prophecy, then you'll get young lions in me in England here. And you'll say Tarshish equals England. We're going to get to Tarshish a little later on. Be careful of your preconceived notions. Don't come to the Bible trying to prove something. Let the Bible speak to you. This is villages. That's what it's got to be. These Sheba and Dedan and Tarshish, they seem to be merchant centers mentioned in chapter 27, verses 12, 15, and 20. Tarshish seems to be either the smeltering area of Spain or, more probably for modern research, the island of Sardinia. And it's not England. You might want to see 1 Chronicles 1, 7 for that. Notice that on that day is mentioned in verse 14 again. All of them riding horses is going to be a cavalry, okay? In the last days, verse 16 again. Verse 17. Are you the ones of whom I spoke in former days through my service, the prophets of Israel? Now, where did this Gog wasn't spoken of by name? Maybe it's this end time intensification of evil that's being spoken of. We're just not sure what Ezekiel is referring to here. Let's see. It will come about on that day. Now, you have that eschatological reference again. That Gog against the land of Israel declares, Lord, in my fury will mount up in my anger. Literally, this means my breath will come in my nose. Well, have you ever got angry and started breathing hard? That's the allusion here to God anthropomorphically. He's going to cause an earthquake in verse 19, going to cause hailstones and fire and brimstone down in verse 22. Some say, ah, nuclear weapons. Well, if this is nuclear weapons, then Sodom and Gomorrah was hit with a nuclear weapon. If this is nuclear weapons, then one of the plagues of Egypt was a nuclear weapon. Be careful of reading into our day all of these prophecies. Boy, I tell you what. Now, notice the sword mentioned in verse 21. Y'all see chapter 23, that famous parable of the sword. Every man's sword will be against his brother in verse 21. That's the panic going to be called, these natural phenomena. The army will kill each other, as God did the same thing in the conquest of the land back in Joshua. The torrential rains and hailstones in verse 22. You might want to see Genesis 19:24, Exodus 7 through 10, Joshua 10:11. Now chapter 39. They're obviously linked together. There are many, many theories about this. I'm not sure I can go through all those. It seems to me we have to relate it contextually to the restoration from the Babylonian captivity. It seems to me we don't have a historical fulfillment recorded in history, and therefore we're continue to pushing this out in the future. Well, you say, do you believe that all of these must literally one day be fulfilled? There are some unfulfilled prophecies. I wish I had them listed here, because when I say that, you'll go nervous on me. I think they're going to be fulfilled, but I'm not sure they're going to be fulfilled in as literal a way as we expect. You know, the disciples continually misinterpreted Jesus by being too literal. And Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament in himself, and many of the things that he said were fulfillments, but they weren't immediately recognized because he slightly altered them. You might want to see Matthew 5, 17 and following, where he takes some standard Old Testament interpretations and changes them to a higher level of intensity. So I think God's going to do what he said. Yeah, because he's God. This is an inspired book. But whether which theory has the right insight, I don't know. I just don't know. Notice these names are mentioned again in verse 1. It says from the remote parts of the north, verse 2. It's a symbol of evil, or it's that land invasion route because they couldn't come across the desert. Notice it says, and I shall send fire upon Magog and those who inhabit the coastlands. Now, the word coastlands means islands, but some interpret it coastlands. You might want to see 38:22. And notice it's not going to fall on Israel. Some say, well, it's going to fall. It's going to fall on Magog. Wait a minute. The guy's name is Gog. Magog is the land where he's from. So the fire is not going to fall on the land of Israel. That'd kill the Israelites too, people of God. It's going to fall on their homeland. While the army is in Israel getting wiped out, the homeland's going to be rained on with fire. That's the idea. Why the coastlands? Well, back here in this in chapter 38, verse 13, some have said these people are saying, oh, don't hurt Israel. They're not saying that. They're following the invasion. They're saying, can we sell these slaves for you? Would you like a market for your spoils? Can we help you disseminate them? For the coastlands is the maritime people. And they want the commercial rights to all this plunder. Now, let's see. Notice verse 7. And the nations will know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. Now, you ought to see chapter 36:22, and look over at verse 23 of this same chapter. God says, the nations will know that the house of Israel went into exile for their iniquity because they acted treacherously against me. Look back at verse 21. I shall set my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see my judgment which I have executed and my hand which I laid on them. God's trying to get his name untarnished. You see, when they were taken into exile, they thought, well, God's so weak, Marduk has taken him captive. God said, nobody took me captive. I took my own people out of the land because they sinned. And to prove to them that I'm going to protect them, and to prove to the Gentiles that I am the only God, I am going to show you a defeat of a large Gentile army like you won't believe. Now, that seems to be what the chapter is about God's name. Notice it says it's going to take 7 years to make fires of them, verse 9. This implies wooden weapons if you're too literal, but don't push the details. It's talking about military equipment. And it shows how much equipment. You say, well, you can't burn metal. We're not talking about that. That's not the truth here. The weapons are so many, the army is so large, that they're not going to cut down trees. They're going to use the weapons for firewood for 7 years. Speak to the largeness of the army. Okay? Let's see. Notice verse 11, we have on that day again, the valley of those who passed by the east. There was a highway that ran to the east of the Dead Sea. They're going to bury this army outside the land of Israel in this Dead Sea area. And they're going to bury them on the other side of the Dead Sea, right by that big highway that goes down there. And they're going to not bury, it's going to pile them up over there. The stink's going to be so bad. There's going to be so many piles of bones that you can't get through that highway. And that seems to be the illusion all the way through here. And they're going to call it the Valley of Haman Gog, which means the multitudes of Gog. There's going to be so many, it's going to take everybody in Israel 7 months to bury them. Then they're going to appoint a committee to go throughout the land and try to find the rest of the bones. Why? Because a person's body unburied polluted the land. Goes back to Leviticus. Ezekiel's a priest. And so they're going to have that committee, and anybody who finds bones will set up a marker, and they'll have them moved over to the burial ground. Okay? You see that in verse 15. Hamath is mentioned again in verse 15 and 16. Let's see. Look at verse 17. As for you, son of man, thus says the Lord God, speak to every kind of bird, every beast of the field, assemble them together from every side to my sacrifice, which I'm going to sacrifice for you as a great sacrifice in the mountains of Israel. And you may eat flesh and drink blood. Oh, choke. verses 17 through 20 are speaking about God offering a sacrifice to the animals of the dead soldiers. And they can eat all they want to. Oh, well, this is wild. You might want to see, I think, an allusion here to, it seems like a communal meal, but it's for animals. And you might want to see Revelation 19, 17 and 18, where the same kind of language is used. John obviously draws his symbolism from Daniel primarily, Zechariah, and Ezekiel, and Daniel. So all of the book of the Revelation is, and those metaphors are drawn from those four Old Testament books. Daniel, Ezekiel, Zechariah, and it's obvious there. So you might want to look at those. Now, exactly what that all means, I don't know, but it's, again, it's speaking of a great carnage, and the animals are going to come. Okay? Let's see. By the way, blood was not allowed. Eating fat was not allowed. So it shows the ceremony and purity. It's not for men. It's for animals. In verse 21 through 24 is the central purpose of all this, that God's name is going to be lifted up. And I don't know what else you're going to say. Let me mention down verse 25. Now I'll restore the fortunes of Jacob. This is the central theme of chapters 33 through 39. You can't pull 38 and 39 completely out of the system and just drop it over on the book of the Revelation or something. It's in a historical context, a literary context, of the restoration of the Babylonian exiles, along with those from Israel who want to come. And it's going to be a unified people. Now, you can't take it out of that historical setting, though we can't fit this battle into it either. What do you do? Verse 29, I will not hide my face any longer, for I have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel, declares the Lord. Now, this pouring out of his spirit is a sign of the new age. And here we have God, another, like the latter days, and the use of the Messiah, David, in chapter 37, all point to end time events. This, I'll pour my spirit out on them, sounds like the prophecy of Joel, chapter 2, verse 28 and 29. Fulfilled at Pentecost. You say, well, Bob, are you expecting an end time battle? Yes and no. My theology does not personally have to have a physical battle for God to be God and for a supernatural God to usher in his will for his world. But if God wants to have a battle, and if this needs to be fulfilled literally, I'm for it. I just know God's in control. I believe the Bible's supernatural. I believe it's inspired. I don't think we ought to treat it casually. I think it does include metaphor, symbol, apocalyptic language. I don't think it's going to be literally fulfilled in every detail. I don't like splitting Israel from the church. I like the church being spiritual Israel. If there's going to be an end time war, it's not going to be just the Jews against the world. It's going to be the people of God against the world, those who know Jesus. And I think what we tend to do is just take a little bit from Ezekiel, a little bit from Daniel, a little bit from Isaiah, a little bit from 2 Thessalonians. We kind of whip it together and put a 70-foot chart on the wall. God is God. And he is going to bring it about. How exactly, I don't know. The metaphor I usually use is that I think these events are true and accurate because they're in the Bible. But it's like a family album that someone has taken some of the pictures out and has switched some of the order. The pictures are true family pictures. So are these prophecies. But how exactly they fit together, in what context they're going to be used, exactly to what extent the details are going to be in place, I honestly don't know. I remember when I went through Revelation verse by verse, Daniel verse by verse, Zechariah verse by verse, and tried so hard to fit everything together literally. I really wanted it all to fit so neat, like a crossword puzzle. And I want to tell you, the more I tried, the more I began to realize that we can't do that to the Bible.